Hello, Clear Skies Ahead listeners. This is Kelly Savoy, and I'm hoping you can take a moment of your time to rate and review our show wherever you listen to podcasts. We have produced over 60 episodes, and you can help us reach even more individuals that will benefit from the diverse experiences shared by our guests. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy this new episode. Welcome to the American Meteorological Society's podcast series, Clear Skies Ahead, conversations about careers in meteorology and beyond. I'm Kelly Savoy, and I'm here with Emma Collins, and we'll be your hosts. We're excited to give you the opportunity to step into the shoes of an expert working in weather, water, and climate sciences.
We're happy to introduce today's guest, Jan Knoll, forensic meteorologist and certified consulting meteorologist at Golden Gate Weather Services in Half Moon Bay, California, and the 2023 recipient of the Henry T. Harrison Award. Welcome, Jan. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Jan, could you tell us a little bit about what sparked your interest in atmospheric science and how it influenced your educational path?
Sure. So, you know, unlike a lot of meteorologists that I've worked with anyway over the years who began taking, you know, rainfall readings when they were 7 years old or so, I was more of a science generalist. I was always interested in math and science. Those are certainly always my favorites in school. And actually, in my high school yearbook, I put that, you know, I wanted to go on and get a degree in physics and become a physics teacher. I had a very inspirational physics teacher in high school that was sort of led me on that path. That sort of morphed into when in my freshman year in college, I became interested in astronomy. So I sort of bent off in that direction. I was actually working as a part-time at a local Chabot Observatory in Oakland, California, giving tours and explaining the telescope, and was really, really enamored with that, not realizing that that was a fairly narrow career path. At the beginning of my third quarter of my freshman year, my life sort of took a hard right turn, and I began 3 years in the Army, including a all-expenses-paid trip to Southeast Asia in 1969. The big takeaway meteorologically for that was I did get to experience my one and only typhoon.
Oh, wow.
And then I got out of the Army, came back to school, was going to transfer to University of California at Davis, and I happened to see a flyer for the atmospheric science program at Davis. So I contacted them, went up and did a visit, chatted with them, and it really seemed to kind of fit into the sorts of things that I liked. I liked the fact that it was, you know, very much in a lot of meteorology was in real time, the very, very sort of synoptic scale stuff that they were looking at the time. And so that sort of, that is how my trajectory got into meteorology.
And so you have to tell us about the typhoon. What was that like, experiencing that?
It was, in some ways, it was a blessing because it meant that basically all activity stops. You know, everyone sort of hunkers down. I was in aviation and helicopters at the time, so we were all grounded. And actually, some of our helicopters were flown out of the area to be in a safer part of the country. So lots of wind and rain, and sort of just hunkering down. It was actually, from that point of view, it was a good thing as opposed to some of the day-to-day stuff.
So what opportunities did you pursue inside and outside of school that you knew would be beneficial to securing a job in your profession?
You know, probably the best one was between my junior and senior years, there was a job announcement for a student trainee at the National Weather Service River Forecast Center in Sacramento, which is about 15 miles away from Davis. And just about everyone else in the department had applied for it. But I had veteran status, and it was a federal job. And actually, that ended up being the deciding factor. Hopefully it was some of my other attributes as well. But, you know, it was a great job. It got me sort of my foot in the door. After that summer, when you're a student trainee like that, you actually you remain on the National Weather Service rolls on leave without pay. So I was generally guaranteed a job when I graduated, someplace within the National Weather Service. It could have been any place. You know, basically, as long as I graduated and didn't commit any felonies in the interim, I had a job. And so that, you know, that was really a big thing coming out of school, knowing I was going to go to work in my chosen field.
So tell us, did you end up having a professional job in the National Weather Service, or did you start doing something else?
No, literally the week after I graduated, I started with the National Weather Service, and I was able to get a job with the National Weather Service in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is where I'm a native of, which, you know, I'm sure you've talked to lots of other National Weather Service people. They have to relocate and move around all through their careers. I started out at home and literally stayed my entire career in the San Francisco Bay Area.
That's lucky.
There were just lots of little things that happened along the way. You know, I became an intern in 1974. And yes, those with your calculators, that's 50 years, coming up on 50 years ago. Seems like it was, you know, just yesterday sometimes. I worked up through the intern program and became a journeyman forecaster at the National Weather Service office in Redwood City. At that point, to advance to the next level, which would have been a GS-12, there were no GS-12s in the local area, so I was looking to have to move. Well, in 1980, they opened the Center Weather Service Unit at the Air Traffic Control Center at Oakland Center. And I was selected as a meteorologist in charge at opening up this new office. And it was actually, when I was working in Redwood City, it was like, you know, a 30-minute commute across the bay. This was a 10-minute bicycle ride from where I was living at the time.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, lots of the, you know, things just kind of kept falling along the way. So I worked at the Center Weather Service Unit for 3 years. And then a lead forecaster job at the next promotion level opened up back in Redwood City. So in 1983, I became a lead forecaster at the National Weather Service. And again, with going all the way from GS-5 to GS-14 without moving is certainly rare. I don't know if unheard of, but doesn't happen very often. As a lead forecaster, you know, besides obviously the shift in operational duties, I was, you become a program leader in lots of different things. And over the years, I was a hydrology focal point, a disaster preparedness meteorologist. I was an AFOS systems manager. So, you know, I got to learn lots of different moving parts, which would all kind of come into play with the second part of my career, which I'm sure we'll chat about. I also developed one of the first National Weather Service websites back in 1994. The other thing that happened in 1994, though, was that they moved the National Weather Service office from the Bay Area down to Monterey. So I commuted there for about 3.5 years, about an hour and a half commute each way. And that was getting kind of old. And what happened, though, at the end of 1997, they were trying to do some downsizing of government, and they were offering early retirements to people who had met certain criteria. I had worked for the National Weather Service for more than 20 years at the time. It was like 23 and a half, something like that. And so I qualified for an early retirement. So I decided to, you know, to take that option to leave the federal government. If I can mention that, you know, overlaid on top of, you know, almost 24 years of working rotating shifts, I had gone back to school and gotten my master's. It took me 13 years. Again, that might be a record. Usually they kick you out after, you know, five years or so.
Five or six.
But yeah, but I kept getting extensions. I was, you know, working with a great professor who, you know, I was doing a lot of El Nino research and stuff like that, that dovetailed with what he liked. And so, you know, he understood my situation with, you know, doing shift work, raising a family, you know, all those other things. I also, in 1987, began teaching one night a week part-time at San Francisco State, one night a week teaching an intro to meteorology class. And I did that for 25 years there, and then another 5 years at San Jose State. The great advantage of it, so this gave me, you know, feet in two of the three sectors of the enterprise, you know, in private and in public, and or I'm in education and public, and then I was going into the private. So, you know, I had lots of different sort of skill sets and things that I could bring into the job of being a forensic meteorologist.
Yeah, and I was going to say, you'd be an incredible mentor to someone. So any listeners here, you know, Jan is on our career advising portal as a career advisor. So I recommend you get in contact with him. Because no, that's incredible, though.
Thank you. And you know, I'm more than happy with talking to people. It's really important for people to have mentors at all levels of their careers, not just when they're starting out, even people in mid or late careers. I've been fortunate to, you know, to be a mentor with other people starting up consulting businesses and wanting to know, well, you know, okay, how do you get started? What are some of the tools you use and things like that? So,
yeah, we're going to ask you all about that.
Okay. Let's keep going.
Yes. So you left the National Weather Service early, and that's when you started your consulting business, right?
Yes. I started Golden Gate Weather Services.
What are some of the daily duties of a forensic meteorologist? Do you have daily duties?
You know, it's, again, you get to wear multiple hats. One is running a small business, you know, doing invoicing and attracting clients, doing social media, doing outreach. I do a lot of media interviews, and that was a carryover from working for the National Weather Service. I did a lot of outreach and interviews for them. Those same people, especially after the Weather Service moved out of the area, I still get, you know, weekly calls from the media about the topic of the day, be it Tule fog or be it El Nino. And that sort of keeps, number one, it keeps me fresh and at explaining things. But and it also is, you know, it's good free publicity. And you know, it's a really good way to, you know, to maintain outreach. And you know, and again, part of the business part, you know, I'll give brown bag lunches for attorneys. They're looking for continuing education sorts of things that they can check off. And I don't know, I've ever given a brown bag lunch when I haven't come out with a referral for a new case. And so I have the business side, and then, you know, all this has to do with communications, you know, finding out what the sorts of things that a client really needs. They'll call up and say, you know, I like what the weather forecast was on December 19th, 2021. And they really don't want the forecast. They want to know what the weather observations were. Or, you know, explaining to them about the different tools that you can bring to the job. You know, it might be radar, or it might be you know, different types of soundings, or explaining that, you know, where weather measurements are taken. And so a lot of that, again, goes back to the, you know, the leg up I had from teaching. And, you know, sometime within the last semester, I talked about, you know, Santa Ana winds or El Nino or, you know, monsoons or different things that are relevant. So, you know, a lot of it is being able to share that knowledge. And you know, figure out what's important to as far as who the clients are. Of the, you know, in a typical day, I'd say I probably work 2 hours on actual meteorology, of actually analyzing data and crunching data. The rest of the day is maintaining a business and doing other associated outreach things, some of the other work that I also do on the side.
And so, do you actually have to go in a courtroom? Do you do expert witness testimony ever?
Yes. So in 25-ish years, I've probably been retained in a little over 700 cases.
Oh, my goodness.
Of those, I've had depositions in about 130. And I've testified in court about 40 times. So,
well, the answer is yes.
That is pretty much a yes. And you know, and the great thing about those, you know, I love the challenges of depositions and trials. You know, it can kind of seem a little intimidating at first. The very first time that I testified, it was in a Superior Court in San Francisco. And I got sworn in, and the judge turns to me and he goes, you know, you don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. You know, it was such a non sequitur, but it really relaxed me. But, you know, in all these things, you are the expert. You know what you know. And, you know, if everyone else knew it, you wouldn't be up there. And that was something, you know, I learned pretty early on. And you need to have that self-confidence so that you can explain things in a meaningful manner. Also, understanding the sorts of things that, you know, that a jury wants to see and what they can understand. I mean, I can come up with formulas and all sorts of other things, but if I show a weather radar like they've seen on the nightly news every night, that really resonates with them. And so, you know, it's kind of, you don't want to dumb it down, but you need to keep it simple. And that is, you know, I really advise other people that want to go into this realm of meteorology, that you don't want to overcomplicate it. You don't want to, you know, write a report that's an academic paper. It will get lost along the way. Shorter is better.
And so what do you like most about your job as a forensic meteorologist?
Oh, you know, I think it's the challenges and the variety. You know, every day is different. Every case is different. You know, again, from all the outreach I've done, I love sharing knowledge. I love teaching, educating, whether it's explaining it to a lawyer as, you know, while he's trying to retain me, to at a deposition, at a trial, or in other sort of outreach, talking to the media or into for webinars and things like that. So, you know, it's teaching is the other big part of it.
You've offered some really excellent advice for experts in their fields already, but do you have any advice for individuals looking to establish their own consulting business?
Probably number one is find a mentor. And there are lots of mentors out there. I'm happy to help, but you know, you all don't have to call me.
you know, say, watch your email.
Yeah. Network. You know, talk to people within the meteorology field, even if they're not other forensic meteorologists. Keep connected with meteorology. Do lots of outreach, as I've talked about. Have business and computer skills. You know, I think, you know, everything is so dependent upon now of knowing where to find information. When I started private consulting back in 1998, if I needed information, I had to go to the library to look up old local climatological data books. And now, you know, all that's at my fingertips. And but you need those skills to be able to find that information, know more than anybody else about the data in your area, the area that you're working in. You also have to learn when to say no. There will be times when a case will come along and you're not able to help the attorney. You know, it's not an act of God rainstorm that's going to help their client. And even though it means saying, hey, you know, I'm not able to help you here, that, you know, that's valuable to them to so that they don't put resources into something that might be some sort of a non-starter. So and probably the biggest thing is integrity. I actually have a coffee mug that I've had for years that I got at a conference, and it says integrity on it. And, you know, as far as working with the legal system in general and testifying, you never want anything to come back on you. And you want to be able to, you know, you want to be able to wake up the next day and say, you know, I really did this right. And probably the last thing is to, you have to gain some experience if you're going to, you know, if you're going to go testify in court. You're not going to come out of school and say, okay, I want to be an expert witness. You have to have that credibility of, you know, having worked along the way.
And I'm sure that you've had to say no at times too, if it's beyond your expertise or if it's in a field that you're not well versed at, and you wouldn't be any help if you took the job and then didn't know what you were talking about.
Oh, that's an incredibly important thing, Kelly. You know, to know what your lane is, so that you, and I often say, for example, if it's a flooding case that I'm working on. You know, I've told more than a dozen attorneys, dozens of attorneys, that, you know, once the rain hits the ground, it's someone else's expertise, be it a hydrologist or a geologist. So you have to know where your knowledge and your skill level and what makes you an expert, where that ends. If the wind is blowing against a tree, I can tell you how strong the wind is, but it's going to be the arborist who's going to tell you, you know, where that, you know, where the leaves on the tree, how much wind it would take for that tree to have fallen over. And that kind of circles back into the networking thing, because you also want to network with other experts.
Right.
on a very regular basis. You know, I'll have a case that, let's say, again, regarding a tree. So I'll refer them to an arborist I've worked with in a past, or a hydrologist for a flooding case. And they likewise refer people to me. They get called into a flooding case, but they say, we're going to need to know what the rainfall is. So why don't you give Jan a call?
Yeah, it works both ways, you know?
It absolutely does. It's that old networking thing.
So you've been involved in ongoing research on the topic of pediatric vehicular heat stroke. Could you tell us a little bit about that? It's a tough thing to talk about.
It is. And, you know, it's become my passion project. It's a way that, you know, I'm able to give back to the community. And I urge everyone along the course of their career, and I'm fortunate that this story came to me in my second career, when I had some time and the ability to give back. But everybody should have a passion project on the side. You know, it's these sorts of things that, you know, that really are able to keep you going. But I became involved with pediatric vehicular heat stroke, which, you know, is basically when children are in hot cars, they get overcome by the heat. They die of heat stroke, also called hyperthermia. I got involved back in 2001 when a 5-month-old child, Kyle Patrick Gilbert, was left in a car by a parent in San Jose, and I got a call from the local media and saying, "Hey, Jen, you know, how hot could have gotten in that car?" And I go, "Well, you know, I can Google that. I can tell you what, you know, give you an answer." Well, there really weren't any very good studies out there. There's one, you know, out of Louisiana from the medical association there. Number one was poorly done and wasn't really on point. And so I started keeping track of temperatures in my vehicle that summer, and was really astounded, number one, how hot cars got, but also how rapidly the temperature rises were. So the next year, I did a controlled study looking at 16 different days, temperatures between 72 and 96 degrees, looking at how fast the vehicles heated up and you know, how rapidly that was over the course of an hour. At that point, I had this data, and I'd had through another project, I had a relationship with the head of emergency medicine at Stanford. So I called him. I go, "You know, I've been looking at heat stroke. You know, do you have any expertise in this? You know, I'd like to, you know, look for avenues that I can share this data." He goes, "I have two great residents, third-year residents that need a project. They would probably love to work with you." So I ended up working with them, and in the 2005, we ended up publishing this in the American Academy of Pediatrics. And I believe I'm still the only meteorologist to publish in that journal. That study has become the go-to study on the topic in the United States for sure, and possibly, you know, around the world. I get, you know, see lots of citations from other places. That led me to working with a lot of child safety organizations. I would go talk to them about how hot cars got. They had been looking for information, you know, about the science behind it. So I was able to provide that. That all kind of morphed into my tracking cases, developing a website called noheatstroke.org, which is a national database. I actually now have a small grant from the National Safety Council and NHTSA to maintain that database. But the bulk of that has been pro bono over the years. And, you know, it's one of the best things that I do, despite the sad topic. It's a very, very much a feel-good thing and a way that I can give back. And again, I encourage everyone to find that way that resonates with you.
So I have a couple of questions. The first question is, give us an example. How hot does a car get in, you know, a couple of minutes? Say it's 70 degrees out.
And 70 degrees can lead to temperatures that are can be fatal for an infant or a small child. So in the first 10 minutes, a vehicle heats up about 19 degrees from whatever the ambient air temperature was. And that was one of the really interesting things from the study. Whether you're starting at 70 or starting at 90, that first 10 minutes goes up 19 degrees on average.
Jeez.
After a half an hour, it has gone up 34 degrees over the ambient air temperature. And after an hour, it's close to 45 degrees. So your 70-degree day is now 115 degrees in a car. If it's a 90-degree day, you're at 135. None of these are survivable temperatures. So, unfortunately, you know, the sets of circumstances that lead to these cases are all tragic. About half the cases are where parents accidentally leave a child in a car. They forget that the child is, they get out of the car, they forget the child is in there. You know, we know how we all, you know, go on automatic pilot sometimes. We've all missed the exit that we always get off every day. We're thinking about something else, you know, what the next podcast is going to be. You just keep on driving. And so there are, you know, the real psychological reasons why people forget things. So there are now lots of pushes for technology, but that takes a long time to get implemented, especially an underserved community. Another quarter of the cases are where children gain access to a car on their own. Car is unlocked in the driveway. They get in the car, they get overcome by the heat, and they don't survive. And then final, about 20% are where parents knowingly leave a child in a car while they go do something else. Sometimes it's a short, you know, trip into the bank. But, you know, you get behind the person that has 17 checks to deposit and everything.
Right.
And that, you know, that five-minute trip becomes a 20-minute trip. Well, an 80-degree day, that car is now at 100 degrees.
Ugh. And so my second question is, has your research, you know, helped? Have the number of deaths gone down?
No.
Oh, no.
It depends how you calculate the metric. Like per capita, yes, there has been a slight decline. And ironically, COVID, with more people working at home, the numbers have dropped off fairly significantly. But, you know, I'm only the first step of the process of providing this information. You know, it needs to be the people in the safety advocacy realm doing their messaging. But I think I've given them some tools. For example, looking at the days of the week that these cases happen. It's more frequent later in the week. Children more often gain access to cars on the weekends. So if they can do their messaging toward those sorts of audiences, that can be more effective.
And you mentioned technology. Emma and I were just talking about that. Remember, Emma?
We were. Yeah, you had mentioned how, you know, technology could catch up a little faster. Only just this year, I have a friend who recently purchased a brand new car and it has sensors in the back seat. She just had a dog crate in the back, but when she went to get out of the car, a notification came up on the car's screen saying, make sure you check your back seat. And it had like a little cartoon of a child's car seat. But that's just this year.
Oh yeah. And there is actually, there part of the last year's Infrastructure Act, their vehicles be mandated to have reminder systems in them and possibly sensor systems in them beginning in 2025. Now, that's all good, but people are keeping cars for on average now 12 years.
Right.
And if you project it forward for the next 20 years, only about 30% of the cars with people having children will have these devices in them. So education, maybe aftermarket devices, still continue to be a very important part of the process. So it's not all going to be, you know, an app very soon.
So you've also earned the Certified Consulting Meteorologist CCM designation. What was that process like, and has the credential been beneficial to you?
Oh, it has certainly been beneficial, and I'll talk about that. Before I left the Weather Service, not even knowing that I was going to take an early retirement, you know, the CCM is sort of the pinnacle of the meteorology profession. You know, it's, first of all, to even apply for it, you need 5 years of professional experience. And then it's a three-part process to be granted it. The first part, you need to have a published paper. I think now it's you need to write a consulting report. You need to have a report of some sort. And then there is an extensive take-home exam. With the time I did it, I think I had 20 questions and I had to answer 16 of them. Again, this is back in 1994. At the time, I was at the National Weather Service Radar School in Norman, Oklahoma for 3 weeks. Not a lot to do in Norman after dark. So each night I would do one question. And it was a way to knock out a lot of the exam with a pretty isolated sort of environment around me, not having to do that. And again, that was all pre-internet. So that was going to the University of Oklahoma library to find a textbook with hydrologic charts in it and things like that. Then finally, there's an oral exam by a panel of other certified consulting meteorologists, and where they test your breadth of knowledge, both for questions that I was asked in the take home exam, as well as sort of your general knowledge and all. And the whole process, the CCM is based on competence, character, and experience. And so, this sort of sorts out the people that are going to really be able to fit that mold. And again, I would add on to that, and sort of adjunct to that is, what I mentioned before is integrity. And that certainly falls into, the competence and character part.
And has it helped in your court cases, attorneys starting to know that credential as being, someone that they would want?
Yes. And it differentiates me, number one, between other people they might be thinking about retaining in a case. But it also really gives me a leg up when the expert on the other side of a case is not a CCM. It's always, my attorney always liked to ask, well, how come you haven't, you haven't tried to get this, this valued credential to add to your resume? So yeah, it's a big plus. And anyone who, is going to be a forensic meteorologist, that needs to be high on the bucket list.
So you've had a very long career. looking back.
Yes.
Is there anything you wish you had done differently?
There really isn't a lot. I've been really fortunate that, the other things that I've talked about were really great stepping stones. The teaching, the 24 years working for the National Weather Service. Not only do they look great on a resume, but they're great as far as background and tools that I've been able to use. So, again, I've been really fortunate, as far as the various things that that have happened for me all the way along the way. So I really can't think of anything really definitive that I would change. I've really been blessed.
That's a great way to end it. But we also like to ask one fun question before you go. So, what is your favorite hobby?
So, I am a relatively obsessive photographer. 4 years ago, I moved to the California coast. There's lots of opportunities for photography here between sunsets, doing night photography with the Milky Way, photographing lighthouses. It has also led to my being able to capture on a very frequent basis, photographing the green flash, which as a meteorologist, I had looked for my entire career. And I've lived in California my whole life and traveled lots of places. Sunset, no green flash. Well, when you look at it through a camera lens, and you can really zoom in on it so you don't burn out your eyes, and you can shoot at a really fast shutter speed, there's very few nights I go out to photograph a sunset that I don't get at least some semblance of a green flash. And I've even now gotten about a half a dozen times when I've gotten a blue flash, which is a really rare, where it's just the right layers in the atmosphere. So everything but the blue has been filtered out. And I last year, I was able to sort of morph some of that photography into an article for WeatherWise about the green flash.
That's so cool.
What was it like when you first captured it? When you first saw that green flash?
I was surprised at what I was seeing. I had to go back and look at it in a little more detail. I actually popped up a histogram, which looks at what the color spectrum is of the photograph. And there was a real spike in the green layer. And so, you know, I go, wow, okay, maybe that is it. And then, you know, as over the last, again, 4 years, you know, I've gotten so I can kind of predict which days are going to be the best days to photograph it. Again, advantage of being a meteorologist and photographer, you know, I know when there's going to be an inversion out over the water, which is kind of the best circumstances. So, you know, it's great to be able to tie my profession and my hobby together.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Jan, and sharing your work experiences with us.
It's been great chatting with you both.
That's our show for today. Please join us next time, rain or shine.
Clear Skies Ahead, conversations about careers in meteorology and beyond, is a podcast by the American Meteorological Society. Our show is edited by Johnny Lay. Technical direction is provided by Peter Killalay. Our theme music is composed and performed by Steve Savoy. And the show is hosted by Emma Collins and Kelly Savoy. You can learn more about the show online at www.ametsoc.org/clear skies. And you can contact us at skypodcast@ametsoc.org if you have any feedback or would like to become a future guest.